Appeals. It is January 13th, 2021. We are now ready to proceed with the third case on our calendar for oral argument. It is the matter of Lee Ray Bulch versus the Commissioner of Public Safety. I'm Judge Bjorkman, and I am joined this morning on the panel by Judges Diane Bratfold and Jeffrey Bryan. We have reviewed all of the written submissions and await your argument. Even though we are proceeding by Zoom as opposed to in person, the same rules concerning oral argument apply, namely that you will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your comments, and counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal should you choose to use it. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you and good morning, Your Honors. My name is Robert Kuba, K-O-U-B as in boy A, and I represent Lee Bulch, who is the appellant in this case. Mr. Bulch appeals the district court order rescinding the revocation of his driver's license stemming from an incident that occurred on September 23rd, 2019 in the city of Worthington, Minnesota. At that time, Officer Gall was coming to the end of his shift. It was approximately 9:55 in the evening. He was positioning his squad vehicle at his home, preparing to finish up some reports when he heard a vehicle and that noise caught his attention due to the fact that there is a city ordinance that controls loud vehicle noises. He saw a truck that he visually estimated to be speeding down the roadway, and he proceeded to pull that vehicle over. At the hearing, Officer Gall indicated that it took a little while for the vehicle to pull over. However, he did specifically state that he did not believe that Mr. Bulch was running. He just simply said that he didn't believe he saw the lights. Officer Gall ended up stopping the vehicle as it pulled into a driveway, positioned a squad car behind it, and approached the driver's side window where he identified the appellant, in this case, Mr. Bulch.
If I could jump in here, I just want to make sure that I understand. I know it seemed like in the district court, one of the arguments had to do with the positioning of the car and in relation to Mr. Bulch's car. But you're not arguing that there was some de facto arrest at that point or probable cause required at that point on appeal, correct?
Partially correct, Judge. I am arguing the probable cause aspect with regards to the factors described in State v. Askaruth, where it said that any expansion must either be justified to
right.
The original.
I just want to clarify that you're not saying that by the officer positioning his vehicle behind Bulch, that required probable cause or that there was some de facto arrest?
I am not arguing that, Your Honor. That is correct. So once Officer Gall approached the window, he identified appellant, and he indicated that he detected an odor of alcohol, but he was not able to articulate where that odor was coming from. I believe the transcript record reflects that he indicated the odor of alcohol could be coming either from the appellant on his person or the compartment of the vehicle. It was at that point that Officer Gall put Mr. Bulch in the front seat of his squad car, and the scope of that expansion is what is unreasonable in this case. Had Officer Gall simply asked Mr. Bulch to exit the vehicle and had a conversation with him outside of the vehicle, that would be a proper expansion. But the issue here and the problem here and what makes this unreasonable is the fact that without any investigation whatsoever, Officer Gall decided to exceed what would be the normal scope of an investigation of a DWI, that is removing an individual from the vehicle to continue that investigation, continue to ask questions by placing him inside the squad car. And that was an unreasonable expansion in this case. The only evidence at that point that Officer Gall had that could lead to something was this odor of alcohol with unknown origin that he testified to rather truthfully that he was not sure where it came from.
Mr. Kuba, are you making, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Judge Brian.
I jumped in just before you did. Are you making a distinction between the method of investigating as opposed to the scope or the focus of the investigation? Typically, when we hear a scope or an expansion of the stop, it's because there's something that's unrelated to DWI that is the initial reason for the stop. And that scope, that investigation then expands to a new crime, a different offense, right? Are you making the similar distinction that there's a difference between expanding the scope to investigate something other than what the initial basis of the stop was and the method of investigation? Because is that a distinction you're making?
That is exactly correct, Your Honor. And as I mentioned in my brief, there's discussion about the duration must be reasonable, the scope must be reasonable, also the methods and means of that investigation and that expansion must also be reasonable. There's discussions from United States v. Navarette Barron and State v. I believe it was State v. Sharp that discussed that that the police are supposed to use the least intrusive means without basically hindsight speculation to conduct their investigation. Again, in this situation, had Officer Gall simply removed Mr. Bulge from the vehicle to inquire further, that wouldn't be an issue. In fact, a lot of the cases cited by respondent and myself, that is exactly what happened. And that is when this court and other courts have found that those expansions were reasonable. The officer conducted their initial stop. There was some suspicions. And so they removed them from the vehicle and continued their investigation. One of those that we both cite is, and I believe that even the district court mentioned in its order, was State v. Lopez, where the officer pulled over the driver for, if I'm not mistaken, it was either having no license plate or a license plate tab violation. I believe it was no license plates. And then upon approach, recognized the temporary paper in the window, approached the driver's side vehicle. In that situation, that officer noticed an odor, determined that there was an odor of alcohol, had the defendant in that case step out of the vehicle, and they conducted a search in that vehicle for the presence of an open container. Again, there's many distinctions between that case, which that expansion was justified in this case. First, and in many, many of the cases that were discussed by respondent in this case, one of the biggest differences is we don't have a situation with multiple individuals in the vehicle. There were a number of cases that were discussed where one of the factors that the court had discussed in those particular cases was the presence of many individuals. Secondly, here we have an unequivocal statement by Officer Gall that the entire purpose for him removing Mr. Bulge from the vehicle and specifically placing him in the squad car was to determine where the odor of alcohol was coming from. This was not
What's improper about that? I mean, isn't that a reasonable investigation, a reasonable method to take them out of the car so that now you're not having to distinguish between odor of alcohol from your client's vehicle and from him, and to put him into another closed container, so to speak, where you can then really learn whether the alcohol is coming from him or not?
Your Honor, I would argue that that is not reasonable because the specific step in placing an individual inside the squad car is an additional height. It's a heightened form of seizure. And that is also discussed in State v. Askaroth, where...
But Mr. Kuba, as you just mentioned earlier, the standard isn't the least intrusive means. The standard is what's reasonable. And there can be multiple things that are reasonable that are in a ranking or a hierarchy, less to more intrusive. So what is it about asking somebody to sit in, and I believe it's the passenger seat of the squad car, to separate that person from the vehicle? What's unreasonable about that?
What's unreasonable, Your Honor, is a person in that situation would not feel free to deny that request or deny questions presented to them by a peace officer. That is a distinctly different situation than being asked to step out of your vehicle and speak with an officer while on the side of the road. There's an increased form of confinement. There's an increased show of authority in that particular situation, even if it is the passenger seat of the squad car, where you have an officer in uniform after having pulled you over with his lights on, indicating that he observed traffic violation, asking you to step out of your vehicle and sit inside his squad car. In a lot of the situations where the court has found that placing an individual inside the squad car was warranted, there have been other circumstances that aren't present here. Again, we have situations where...
So Mr. Kuba, let me just follow up for a brief moment. I don't see where the record reflects how long Mr. Bulch was in the front passenger seat. Am I missing something? Is there an indication of how long?
I believe there is an indication of how long. I believe that Officer Gala testified that he was not in the front seat for very long. I believe that is what Officer Gall had testified to. We're not talking here a situation where he was there for 10 minutes or something of that nature. Going back to before, a lot of the distinctions in these cases where the court has found that placing them in the squad car was reasonable, there have been a couple key instances in a lot of those cases that simply is not present here. Again, one of the main ones is the fact that in a lot of those cases, they discuss the fact that there were multiple individuals located in the suspect vehicle that was stopped. In a couple of the cases that were cited by respondent, I believe State v. Van Wagner and State v. Moffitt. In Van Wagner, there were two individuals passed out in a vehicle. In that particular situation, the court emphasized the fact that there were multiple individuals, as well as the safety for the individuals and for the defendant in that case. They specifically said that in his state, the defendant, Mr. Van Wagner, clearly needed to be placed somewhere for his safety. In addition, State v. Moffitt, we had a situation where not only do we have multiple individuals, there was a vehicle stop for suspected burglary. We had a situation where there were, it was three or four occupants that were suspected for crimes that were considered that where the individuals could be considered could be considered armed and dangerous. And in addition, the court indicated that the separation of the individuals in that situation also was prudent so that they couldn't form a story together while they were sitting in the vehicle. Your Honors, in addition to the expansion issues, the expansion issue, I'm sorry, we have here, Mr. Bolt, we also contend that the district court erred when it admitted the breath test result over objection. We have a situation where the record shows that Mr. Bulch had dentures, that Mr. Bulch had situations where he would often have food trapped in those dentures, as well as we have testimony from Officer Gall, an expert from the Attorney General, Ms. Richardson, as well as an expert that Mr. Bulch called, Mr. Burr, that the BCA procedure says that it is essential that foreign objects are removed, and there is testimony as well that dentures were a foreign object. And if we look at Minnesota Statute 634.16, it states that the prima facie showing from the commissioner must show that the test was performed by a certified operator pursuant to their training. In this case, there is evidence that that was not done pursuant to his training, and that training being that
Mr. Kuba, let me ask you this. As I read your brief and understand your argument, and we basically would have to do a couple of things, find that the district court's findings of fact along these lines are clearly erroneous. And we would also have to really find that the BCA policy that says you don't have to remove dentures is in error. Is that something this court can do on appeal given this record?
Your Honor, I believe it can, given this record. There was testimony from Ms. Richardson, who was the purported expert from the Attorney General on these matters with regards to the breath testing advisory, where she indicated that it was their policy to remove all foreign objects, but she also indicated that the BCA had certain exceptions. I believe she mentioned tongue rings and dentures as two of those exceptions. However, when asked on cross-examination about what scientific evidence they have to justify that exception when they clearly state that it is essential to remove all foreign objects. The only thing that Ms. Richardson was able to point to was a study done in 1992, which at this point is 28 years old. In addition, that study was not done with the Data Master machine that is currently used in the state of Minnesota. That test was performed on the Intoxilizer 5000 machine, which, as this court is well aware, is no longer used in Minnesota, and there's a reason for that. We moved on from that machine for a reason.
The slightly different question as your time's winding down. I want to clarify what you are and are not arguing. Reliability is one of those things that we start with to determine admission, but obviously all evidence has to be weighed by the district court, and the weight of the evidence involves, to some degree, considering its reliability as well. So my question is, if we agree with the state on admission of the test, are you also arguing that it would have been clear error for the court to still find that the blood alcohol content was 0.144?
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly what I'm arguing. And I see that my time is up. So if there are no further questions, I will.
Maybe in rebuttal, you could explain why it would be clear error to conclude 0.144 if the test itself is reliable enough to be admitted.
Certainly, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Corey Marsalek. I represent Respondent Commissioner of Public Safety, asking this court to affirm the district court's holding. I'd like to begin with Judge Bjorkman's statement about how what Officer Gall did was reasonable. It was exactly reasonable because it was able, as you articulated, Your Honor, he was able to quickly confirm or dispel his suspicions about whether or not the odor of alcohol came from appellant. That's exactly what we'd ask under the case law. And to respond to Mr. Marshall,
if I could jump in, because reasonableness is not just an analysis of whether or not what the officer did was efficient or effective, right? It was an effective way of determining the source of the odor. But what I think Mr. Kuba is arguing is that reasonableness also requires some balance of how intrusive the request is from the officer. And I don't think he's saying that it was an ineffective way of determining the source of the alcohol.
I agree with that, Your Honor, that the just because a method is effective doesn't mean that it's also overly intrusive. And your statement gets to the Fourth Amendment and general test of reasonableness by balancing the government's interest against the private interest. In this case, if you look at the prior case law of Minnesota, which we cite about from Van Wagner and Moffitt, the court has stated that simply placing somebody in a police car does not unreasonably extend the intensity of a traffic stop to that beyond a traffic stop. So to answer your question, there are situations, there are techniques that might be efficient but unreasonable. This is not one of them because the court has expressly stated in other circumstances that this method of investigation is not unreasonable.
But Mr. Marsalek, I mean, don't we have to look at the surrounding circumstances? And as Mr. Kuba pointed out, this isn't a situation where there were numerous occupants of Mr. Bolch's vehicle, or there was bad weather or traffic on the side of the road or anything that necessitated placing Mr. Bolch in a squad car, which is, to me, qualitatively different than having them get out of their car and stand at the side of the road. What are the facts here that made placement of Mr. Bolch in the squad car a reasonable expansion of the stop?
Well, what I would say, Your Honor, is that the facts that would illustrate that this is reasonable would be the absence of any other coercive techniques that were used by Officer Gall. As the district court found, Officer Gall merely asked appellant to sit in the front seat of his squad car in order to confirm or dispel his suspicions of alcohol use. He didn't handcuff him. He didn't show his point his fire. He didn't unholster his firearm. He didn't use anything else to sort of coerce or intimidate or pressure the appellant into getting into the squad car. And even once he was in the squad car, they simply had a conversation. He didn't engage in any sort of investigatory tactics that would be more intrusive than simply placing him in the squad car. And while Your Honor is correct that the Moffitt and Van Wagner involved multiple occupants, those cases also rely on Harim, which involved a single occupant who was on a motor vehicle and was suspected of drinking and driving. We did not cite Harim because Harim predates Sharp, and Harim focuses on Miranda as a custodial interrogation. So it's not, the legal analysis is not directly on point, but the factual setting that Moffitt and Van Wagner then incorporated into their analysis is relevant to the situation here.
Is there any testimony about a need to control the environment, or any testimony about unpredictability in this case or generally when investigating DWI offenses?
As far as the conditions are, Your Honor, there was some testimony. I think you could read into Officer Gall's testimony that he wanted to isolate the environment in order to control any sort of external variables that could impact his ability to determine whether or not the odor of alcohol came from appellant. As far as appellant's personal actions and behavior, there is no testimony to suggest that appellant was anything other than cooperative. But again, as far as the conditions are concerned, the reason why Officer Gall placed him in this squad car is to isolate the odor of alcohol. That's what Officer Gall testified to. That's what the district court found. And so in that sense, he's trying to eliminate as many conditions, as many variables as possible that could impact where the odor of alcohol is coming from.
Do you think, given the testimony, we could rely on the fact that Mr. Bolch did not immediately pull over? Or do you think that those added question and answers from the officer would preclude us from making any inference about the need to control the environment based on the time it took before he was pulled over?
I'm not quite sure I understand your question. Is your question getting at whether or not the...
I'll just rephrase it. So it seemed from the testimony that not only did it take a while for Mr. Bolch to pull over, and if that was the end of it, if that was it, then we could potentially look at that testimony and say that that was one of the concerns that Officer Gall had, one of the reasons he might have had to ask him not just to stand by the side of the road, but to actually get in the car with him, is because he was concerned about whether or not this person would remain at the scene or try to flee. However, in this case, we don't just stop there. We also have testimony from Officer Gall saying that he didn't think that Mr. Bolch was trying to evade or leading him on a chase. So my question to you is, can we look to the time it took to pull him over, and can we use that in any way to shed some light on whether the decision to ask Mr. Bolch to sit in the car was reasonable?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe you could, because the reasonableness is an objective inquiry. The fact that Officer Gall subjectively didn't think that appellant was going to evading him, or subjectively thought that appellant's behavior indicated that he was not a flight risk, would be immaterial, because the reasonableness is an objective inquiry. So under the totality of the circumstances, an objectively reasonable officer could conclude that the appellant's failure to stop might indicate that he is a flight risk. So in that sense, I agree, Your Honor. Turning to the second issue in the case about whether or not the district court properly admitted the test results and whether the district court properly relied on the test results, I think it's important to note that there is a distinction between admissibility and reliability in these situations. And so to Judge Bryan's statement to Mr. Kuba about the reliability, I'm willing to disagree with that to a certain extent, because I think the admissibility under the case law is premised specifically on whether or not there was a certified operator and whether or not the diagnostic checks indicated that the machine was working properly and the chemicals were in proper condition. Once those three conditions have been met, then the test is admissible. The appellant's arguments all go toward the weight that the test results should be given, because his sole argument is based on the observation period and based on the any sort of mouth alcohol that could have affected the test. It doesn't go to the three requirements for admissibility. Now, admittedly, the case law in this area is a little muddled, and we have not been the most helpful in that regard as well. But if you start with St. Louis Park versus Quinn, which specifically states that the three tests for admissibility that I reiterated, and then if you look at, I believe it's Kramer, and then State versus Nelson, which also discussed the difference between admissibility and weight. That's so the test in itself is admissible because there is no testimony. The appellant doesn't even challenge any of the three requirements that would go to admissibility. Once the test is admissible, then we get to reliability. And a test is, it becomes the appellant's burden, petitioner's burden, to prove that the test is unreliable.
Right. And at that point, when you say it is admissible, I'm not sure I agree with that, because it has not yet been admitted. All it does is shift the burden on reliability to the defense, but it's not admitted yet. Its admissibility depends on a decision of reliability, right?
Well, I mean, the way I'm hearing your question would be more of a 403 analysis. And
no,
that's...
I'm asking what happens if the defendant carries its burden and shows in this case that it was an unreliable test. What happens then? Is the test admitted but disregarded, or is the test excluded?
I would argue that the test would be admitted but disregarded, because it would be unreliable as a test. But under the case law, you just need the three antecedent requirements for admissibility. And once those have been met, then the test is admissible. And I understand that appellant makes an argument based on 63416 and the procedures, the training. But I mean, one, I don't think that issue is necessarily presented in this case, because we didn't get into the analysis of 63416 in the district court. But to the extent that that would be something to be analyzed, as a matter of statutory interpretation, the training and trained in 63416 refer to the breath test instrument, which again goes to the certified operator, the diagnostic checks, ensuring that the machine is working properly,
so
and ensuring
if I could come back to that statute, because what you're saying seems very different from my understanding of what the law is. My understanding is that the state has a prima facie burden, and you're right that the requirements for the state to establish its prima facie burden do not include reliability. But once that prima facie case has been shown, that does not mean that the test is admitted. My understanding is that, and this is based on the case law, right, that once a prima facie showing of trustworthy administration of the breath test has occurred, then the burden shifts to determine reliability or untrustworthiness, and that decision is what determines admission. So there's a prima facie, and then there's a reliability, and then after that analysis, we have admission. And once it's been admitted, sure, maybe there's arguments that go to the weight of that evidence. But in terms of admissibility, I think you might be misreading the statute to conclude that your prima facie test is all the state has to do to show that something is admissible.
Okay, I think I understand the distinction Your Honor's making. Maybe I didn't understand that as clearly before. You're drawing a distinction between admissible versus admitted. And I think there's an argument there. The case law is just not clear on it, to be candid. And again, we haven't been helpful in that regard, because there are cases that say that once you meet those three antecedent tests, then it's admissible. And then there are other cases that say that you need to weigh in on the reliability before you admit it, versus other cases that say that the reliability just goes to the weight you give the test. So to be candid, Your Honor, I don't have a clear answer to that, because I feel the case law has not been clear, but it's immaterial in this case, because at the end of the day, appellant has to show that something actually affected the test. And appellant cannot show that something actually affected the test, because all he has is he may have had food particles that may have caused mouth alcohol that may have affected the test. The district court expressly concluded that appellant's expert testified that the appellant's expert was unable to testify that there was actually mouth alcohol that affected the test in this case. So we're really sort of having an academic discussion as far as what is admissible and what is admitted, because at the end of the day, appellant's burden is to show that something actually affected the test. And you can look at Junker from 2019. You can go as far back as Pasek from 1986, which dealt with chewing tobacco in somebody's mouth during the test. So it's a very interesting academic discussion, but at the end of the day, in order for appellant to prove that it was unreliable, he has to show that something actually affected the test, and there's nothing in this record to show that appellant actually affected the test. Because again, he didn't even testify that he actually had food particles in his mouth. There's nothing in the record to indicate that he did. All he testified to was that he may have had food particles. He expressly said that he didn't remember when he ate or had anything to drink. So we have no evidence that there was any food particles in his mouth. There's no evidence that those food particles may have caused mouth alcohol. And there's no evidence that the food particles that may have been there that may have caused mouth alcohol that may have affected the test actually did. And
so is there any evidence about how possible it would have been to remove dentures? I don't have a lot of experience with dentures. You don't look like you're at an age where that's an issue for you, but maybe you're a hockey player or something. Is there any evidence that suggests it was even possible to remove those had that been an option?
No, Your Honor. And I see there's nothing in the record to that effect. Thank you, Your Honor. With that, I would ask that this court affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kuba, you will have the last word.
Thank you, honors. I'd like to begin by briefly addressing Judge Bryan's last question, whether or not there was any evidence about how easily removable the dentures were. There is, in fact, evidence in the record that these dentures were extremely easy to remove. There, during the testimony of Mr. Bulch, the record reflected that Mr. Bulch simply popped out his upper dentures in a short amount of time, showed that to the court, and popped them back in. That was an exchange that was expressly during the testimony of Mr. Bulch. So there is evidence that it's extremely easy simply to remove the dentures from the mouth. That's contrasted by the other objects that were excluded from removal pursuant to Ms. Richardson's testimony, i.e. the tongue ring. Obviously, those are two different things that take a lot longer to remove. I would also like to briefly touch on some of the discussions regarding whether or not once the commissioner shows the prima facie showing, is that enough to simply admit the test? It is not. Under our case law, prima facie showing is the first step. From there, the burden then shifts to, in this case, petitioner Mr. Bulch, to show that there was something that affected the test. And I believe that's pursuant to Genung versus Commissioner of Public Safety, I believe is a case that discusses that from 1999. And in this case, and I want to touch on the question that Judge Bryan had asked at the end of my initial discussion, should this court conclude that the test is in fact admissible, we still have a discussion on whether or not, or the weight to place towards the reliability and accuracy of that test. And in this situation, what we are challenging is that the nature of the procedure is what makes this unreliable, not the argument of the presence of mouth alcohol. Because
that second component, I understand the standard of review we would apply to admission of the test results. But as to that second component, the weight that the district court gives to it, that's a clear error standard of review. Do you agree?
Your Honor, yes, I believe that would be a review on clear error. And I think that there is evidence on this record to show that there was clear error. And I think one of the main focuses for that discussion is the evidence that shows that there are three different, for lack of a better term, fail safes to prevent mouth alcohol built into the Data Master machine's testing process. One of those is the observation period. The second is the I don't know what else to call it, but the two tests that are given must be an agreement of 0.02. And third is the negative slope, where in a particular sample, if an individual's breath alcohol manages to spike or dip a certain amount, then the that's considered a fail-safe to help prevent mouth alcohol. The reason the procedure is flawed in this case is two of those three scenarios simply refuse to give a reading. In the negative slope analysis, the Data Master machine itself will not give a breath alcohol amount. It will in fact spit out an error and refuse to display a breath alcohol result. Same thing with the 0.02 argument, or the 0.02 agreeance. In fact, we have a statute on that where if the two tests are not within 0.02 of each other, we are not to use that test because it is inherently flawed. That's even if the other two fail-safes pass. The only fail-safe that the BCA, for unknown reasons, claims doesn't need to be followed and we can still accept that result is the observation period. That is the
It seems to me that, I mean, I don't think the commissioner's saying that there's no, that the observation period isn't important. And I mean, I think the evidence here was that there was a 30-minute observation period. I mean, it seems like the heart of your argument is that leaving the dentures in is just a problem and it undermines the reliability to the extent that it should not have been admitted. But to prevail on that argument, didn't your client need to come forward with affirmative evidence that the presence of dentures means that you're going to have mouth alcohol being captured in the Data Master test?
I believe that there is evidence on this record that would suggest that, Your Honor. I think it goes above the mere speculation as discussed. The commissioner cites one case involving dentures. I believe it was Reynolds v. Commissioner of Public Safety. And if I'm not mistaken, that is an older case where the court, I see my time's up, but if the court, like, I just briefly summarize.
Yes, finish my.
So in Reynolds, they found that dentures alone with no additional evidence is not enough to challenge reliability. And in that case, there was literally zero testimony about anything involving dentures. In this case, we have the testimony from Mr. Burr indicating that food and whatnot can get trapped in those dentures. We have the testimony from Mr. Bulch that he often gets food trapped in his dentures. And I think that is more than what was shown in the Reynolds case. So for those reasons, because the expansion was unreasonable, because the test should not have been admitted, and because there were the improper weight was given to the accuracy and reliability of the test, we ask that you rescind the license revocation.
All right. Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. The arguments were well presented. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. That is the last case scheduled for oral argument, so we will recess to consider the remaining cases. Thank you both.
Thank you.